How much do you really know about the meat on your dinner plate? Journalist Christopher Leonard spent more than a decade covering the country's biggest meat companies, and he's written a new book, The Meat Racket: The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Journalist Jennifer Ait Lee talked with him.
Christopher, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you make a bold claim in your book where you compare farmers in America to serfs. What gave you the confidence to make that comparison?
Well, first of all, it was years of reporting on the ground in the small towns where Tyson Foods operates and where most of the big meat companies in my book operate. And, you know, a serf was a peasant and sort of the lowest ranking person in the feudal system of agriculture many hundreds of years ago. A serf didn't really own their own land, and importantly, they were tied to a lord who told them what to do. And to be honest, I found a very similar situation when I went to small towns like Waldron, Arkansas, where Tyson Foods has an enormous chicken production facility and where it contracts out with farmers to raise chickens. And contract farming is a very interesting structure. You'll have a farmer who will borrow maybe $500,000, maybe as much as $2 million to build a large industrial footprint of these kind of factory farms you might have seen, where they could raise 25,000 chickens in a single barn. But for all the size and scale and sophistication of these farms, the farmer never owns the actual chickens, for example, that are put into these barns. The farmer contracts with a company like Tyson, and Tyson will come and deliver birds and deliver feeds, and the farmer is paid to raise the animals. But the farmers have almost no control over the most important things in the operation. The farmer has no control over what quality of chicks are delivered to the farm, whether they're healthy or not. The farmer doesn't control what kind of feed is delivered to the farm. So essentially, they end up taking orders from a big company like Tyson Foods in the same way a serf might be tied to a lord many, many, many years ago. And back in the 1960s, Tyson Foods was a pioneer in developing this system of contract farming. And Tyson really experimented. They had some operations where they would own the farm itself. They had others where they would hire employees to come and raise the chickens. But what they discovered was that really a factory farm is an awful investment. And a lot of that can be traced back to these actual giant barns, these chicken houses, as they're called, which are just a rotten investment. The things start to lose the value pretty much the day they're finished being built. They're kind of like trailer homes. They corrode in the elements. They serve no other purpose than to raise chickens. So for a company like Tyson, that's a pretty rotten investment. The company would much rather steer its cash into its large slaughterhouses, where it could invest in new machinery that can process chickens much more quickly. And then, you know, furthermore, there's really only so much you can do in terms of getting a chicken to grow fast. I mean, that's not a cost curve you can really bend too sharply. So Tyson and other companies made the decision back in the 1960s that they would go with this arrangement of contract farming where they would entice a local farmer to borrow the money to build those chicken houses and also buy the tremendous amount of land that you would need to go around these chicken houses to absorb some of the chicken litter, and that Tyson would effectively control the farm without owning it, and that sort of rotten investment would be on the balance sheet of the local farmer.
And you have this verb called chickenization or chickenizing. What does that mean?
Yeah, chickenization is a funny word, and it sounds odd. But when you spend a lot of time going around to small towns in rural America where raising meat is still the economic bread and butter, the phrase chickenization is actually a pretty loaded political term. At its most basic element, when you call a meat business chickenized, what you're saying is that it's vertically integrated or very tightly integrated. And by that, I mean a company like Tyson Foods will own all of the components of raising meat that used to be a small business in small-town America. We're talking Tyson Foods will own the hatchery. It will own the feed mill. It will own the slaughterhouse. It will own the company that breeds birds. It will own the trucking line that ships the birds back and forth and then ships the meat out to a warehouse. That integration is at the heart of chickenization, but the word means a lot more than that. When a business becomes chickenized, it essentially means farmers become powerless, transparent markets are replaced by contract arrangements, and companies get a tremendous amount of control over the business. I think maybe the best example when people talk about a business being chickenized would be the pork industry. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, the pork industry was still defined by a lot of independent operators, a lot of mid-sized small operators. You had a really vigorous, transparent market where hogs were traded, and it made a lot of money for a lot of people. I interviewed attorneys in Iowa who were put through law school on hog money, but the business was chickenized over a period of about 20 years. Big companies came in and effectively took it over. They replaced the markets with contracts, and farmers lost autonomy. So they were effectively chickenized. That's what the word means.
And if you go back in American history, I mean, we were not a big chicken-eating country a century ago, but that sort of changed in the last couple of decades. What happened and what role did Tyson play in that?
Well, it really goes back to the late 1920s, and that's when Tyson Foods was founded by this young, brilliant man named John Tyson, who had kind of been kicked off his family farm during the Great Depression because there just wasn't money there to make a living. So at that time, as you said, chicken was a delicacy. It was like lobster. It was a pricey meat that a family might purchase for the big Sunday meal, and you would buy a whole chicken. But the meat was pretty expensive. And this guy in Arkansas, John Tyson, started making a lot of money shipping chickens from Arkansas up to urban markets in St. Louis or Kansas City, for example. But the business grew from there as farmers in the South started getting a lot smarter about how to raise chickens. And people like John Tyson created the system I'm talking about, which is a vertically integrated one where they controlled the feed and other inputs, and they just became experts at raising chickens. I mean, between 1955 and 1982, they managed to shave off the time it took to raise a full-grown chicken by about a third. They took 30% off the time it took to raise a chicken. At the same time, they shaved off the amount of feed you need to raise a chicken by one-third. And then they made the birds one-third bigger. I mean, it was this incredible revolution. So between 1955 and 1982, you're able to raise a bigger chicken in a shorter amount of time on less feed. They did this through aggressive breeding of getting the best genetic lines, coming up with really sophisticated feed formulas, for example, and just mastering this art of raising chickens in these giant, sophisticated warehouses with automatic feeding and watering systems.
And despite the fact that a lot of the people who are raising the chickens are small farmers, the number of companies that actually control what gets to your plate is actually fairly small now. What happened?
That's right. That's one of the most significant changes in this whole business. I interviewed Don Tyson and his close confidants and lieutenants who built the company, and their goal was really clear. They wanted to be big. They wanted to be big, as big as possible, because that really helped the company survive and fatten its profit margins in a pretty volatile business. So Don Tyson went on a just unprecedented acquisition spree. I mean, Tyson Foods bought at least 33 of its competitors, and some of those were major large chicken companies like Holly Farms. And it went from a point where we had a highly competitive chicken industry in the 60s and 70s to a system today where just three companies make about half of all the chicken in the United States, and just two companies make about 40% of the chicken in the United States. And the impact of that is significant, and it's serious for consumers. I document how in 2008, Tyson Foods really hit a rough patch, and it was the kind of rough patch they'd hit all the way back to the 60s, where prices for chicken went down, but prices for feed were still high. So what Tyson did to react to that was it cut production. That's a natural reaction, right? Well, the difference between 2008 and 1961 is that Tyson Foods controlled almost 25% of the market. You know, back in the 70s, companies would have to meet and collude and have secret meetings and plan production cuts to achieve the same kind of production cuts that Tyson could do in 2008 with a simple order from the central office. These companies have a market power that is unprecedented in the United States, and it gives them a strong lever over the meat industry, and the results have been really clear. Tyson was able to cut production. It has done that many times since 2008, and its profits are rising. It reported record profits last year, even as meat prices go up.
So let's say you're a chicken eater like I am, and you're really bothered by how the system has evolved. Is there anything we can do as consumers? Is the answer not to eat chicken? Is the answer to eat less chicken or more chicken, like, or to eat organic chicken? What choices are out there?
Well, certainly everybody has to make that decision for themselves. I eat chicken, and I do not advocate a vegetarian diet, although I really understand why some people do that. I understand where they're coming from. I just do think chicken is an affordable source of healthy protein. So I think the most expensive option for people out there is to simply opt out of this system. I mean, there's a really vibrant movement of, you know, this quote-unquote locavore movement, where you can go to a farmer's market where a local farm will sell chicken on a subscription basis. You know exactly where that chicken's raised. 100% of the food dollar you're spending goes to the farmer. But that's expensive. I think it's about three times as expensive. And that's asking a lot of consumers. Yeah, and I mean, look, I'm writing about the meat that's delivered to hospitals, cafeterias, grocery stores. Most middle-income Americans can't afford to buy meat at the farmer's market. And unfortunately, I think with the issues I'm talking about in this book, there's not an easy fix. What we're looking at is a system that has basically gone back 100 years to being in a state of oligopoly, where a few companies have tremendous market power and competition has dwindled significantly. I think part of the solution probably has to be political. I mean, the only entity, when you look around at the landscape, what entity could help curb the power of a corporation that has, almost $1 billion in profit? I think federal antitrust authorities are about the only people in the landscape that could help curb some of the market power these companies have been given.
And your book actually details some of the efforts that the Obama administration made towards doing that, but the results have been mixed. What happened when they started trying to do policy changes around the agribusiness?
Well, Barack Obama came into office advocating some very sweeping changes and some very strong antitrust efforts on this front. And he hired a lot of people into the U.S. Department of Agriculture that had seen firsthand a lot of the problems going on out on chicken farms and in rural America. They held a series of unprecedented workshops around the country where the Department of Justice and the Department of Agriculture had joint hearings on this problem. I mean, you had the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, seated right next to the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, listening to farmers talk about a lot of the stuff that's in my book. It was an unprecedented effort. But it seemed like the administration was almost surprised when the meat industry put its lobbying machine into effect and started fighting back on these rules. And what resulted in 2010 and 2011 was a truly inept and dilatory and ineffective effort on behalf of the USDA. They ended up backing off the vast majority of the reforms they had proposed. Other reforms were defunded by Congress, where the meat lobbyists spent millions of dollars to enlist legislators to beat back the efforts. Interestingly enough, the meat industry even enlisted contract chicken farmers to write letters asking not to have protections that would have been enacted under some of these new laws. So the effort was broken and abandoned and left behind, and essentially nothing came out of those hearings or the years of hard work. which I think actually left the meat monopolies in a much stronger position than they were before Obama came into office, because there was an attempt at reform and it failed, which in effect has kind of legitimized a lot of the practices that these companies are undertaking right now today.
Thank you, Christopher, for joining us. You've certainly given us a lot to think about today.
Thanks so much for the time.
Christopher Leonard is a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of The Meat Racket. Jennifer Aid Lee is the publisher of Daily Lit and the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Well, for more information, head to the website, splendidtable.org.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.